Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Imagine, if you will, an artist instead of a politician in the White House. This possibility existed in 1984 in reality, not in the George Orwell novel. Susanna Bixby Dakin, a sometimes resident of Santa Monica, California, and sometimes of Mendocino County, California, and sculptor by training, conceived of her national campaign for the presidency of the United States as a one-year durational art performance piece. Although Sue Dakin, as she is now known, was defeated, having been effectively overshadowed by the second-term campaign of Ronald Reagan, Dakin continued to practice what she calls system sculpture in her political, spiritual, and art life. This unusual episode in American political campaign history is revealed in Dakin's book, An Artist for President, The Nation is the Artwork and We Are the Artists, published in 2011. Mariah Gallardon, host of TUC Radio and a friend of Sue Dakin and I, joined us in the studios of Radio Curious on November 25th, 2011, in conversation with Sue Dakin about her life and book. Susanna Dakin, welcome to Radio Curious.
Well, thank you.
And I also want to welcome Mariah Gallardon. And Mariah produces TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here with both of you.
Susanna, you engaged in your 1984 campaign for President of the United States with the idea of presenting new concepts of creativity, politics, and spirituality. What did you have in mind with those ideas?
I think the rigorous practice of art and art making and good politics and spiritual pursuit is basically all the same thing.
What would a rigorous practice look like in a political sense for the president?
Well, that we be as conscious as possible of the consequences of everything and anything we do. Pay attention to what happens across the board. Have policies that benefit me or my immediate constituencies, or I can have policies that benefit a much wider circle, and ultimately do something to preserve the livability and friendliness of the planet itself.
The particular practices, that obviously deals with unintended consequences. Some politicians go onto the campaign trail with a specific unspoken agenda in mind. Did you have one?
I did have an agenda, and that is to try to convince large masses of people that the arts are very important in the development of intelligence and general consciousness in the populace. And the problem is, of course, that the arts are, to a large extent, political casualties in the last 40, 50 years.
Your area of art is sculpture.
Right.
What are the political consequences of sculpture?
Well, as I say, I used to be what I'd call an ivory tower artist. I just made whatever three-dimensional things I was making. And gradually I began to feel growing need to have some kind of art practice that was much more interactive with people around me. And somewhere along the way, this idea came of doing system sculpture, which is basically the carving away or adding to whatever the system is in a way to improve it for the benefit.
What would a system sculpture look like in the eyes of the beholder?
Any kind of careful attempt to improve anything from sewage systems to educational systems to communication systems, transportation systems.
Can you describe for us what some of your system sculptures look like?
Most of mine are in the form of proposals at this point, but one being that in terms of national transportation, we should emphasize the railroads more than the airlines, and for long distances develop things like bullet trains and so on, with great consciousness of the kinds of fuel used, various impacts on the environment.
I have a different image in my mind of the term sculpture. Michelangelo's sculpture, something that looks like a person that's manifested on a material plane.
I like that approach to sculpture very much. I've been all my life fascinated by Michelangelo's use of the phrase that what we need to do is remove what is unnecessary. I think the first time that I began to think of this as possibly a social enterprise as well as a material, you know, clay, wood, stone enterprise was when I saw a performance artist present his performance, a fellow by the name of Raivo Pusemp. He lived in a little village in upstate New York, which had tremendous problems in that it had a sewage system which was contaminating the water system. And it was a problem that the elected officials had supposedly been trying to deal with for a long time, but there was basic kind of political corruption of a very common kind. I don't know the details, but it just wasn't happening. And he and a friend of his, he ran for mayor, and the friend ran for village council, whatever it would be called. And between the two of them, they presented this program to eliminate what was unnecessary, which was the contamination of the water system. And they were elected. And over a period of time, they succeeded in eliminating the contamination problem. And then they went on, basically, to eliminate the job of mayor. Because the little local village political system was just a redundancy that the larger township council or whatever it was could do the job much more efficiently. And Pusemp was certain that he had achieved Michelangelo's end of removing what was unnecessary.
I have one more question about sculpture, but I really want to talk about your reflections on your campaign for President of the United States that occurred in 1984. But the last question is, you write that you've always had a conflict or a war within yourself. One is the desire for art to be seen, and the other is a compulsion to make yourself as invisible as possible. How did you deal with that conflict as a politician?
Well, I never really thought of myself as a politician.
Even though you were running for president.
Right, right. Because I think of a politician as someone who has mastered the specific political art form called politics. And I did not feel myself to be a master of that art form. But as an artist of a different kind, I think I was early in life really kind of confusing the kind of egotism that goes along with excessive celebrity worship, which is very common in this country.
Particularly of politicians.
Politicians, artists, and of all kinds. Movie stars, sports champions. Just about anybody who stands out a little bit with their abilities or just their charisma, whatever it happens to be, is inflated as a kind of super celebrity.
I've been wearing your button, An Artist for President, and I'm getting a huge response. People seem to fear this button was made for now. Have you had that experience?
A little bit. Some people are saying that this book is coming out now, right at the right time. After the campaign was over, I went through a period of kind of deep discouragement because I really felt I had kind of failed in doing what I wanted to do, and and had not really brought it to a real completion. I think the book now is bringing it to a completion, and the subtitle of the book is "The Country is the Artwork, the Nation is the Artwork, and We are the Artists. We the people are the artists." And what the point of that phrase, "An Artist for President," is, if we can ourselves, every single one of us, in one way or another, become artists, then inevitably we will eventually have an artist for president. It wasn't that I was putting myself as a celebrity artist, which I'm not, forward as president. I was just kind of putting that idea forward that we all need to really do our best to perfect whatever our art forms are, and eventually we'll have an artist for president.
How would that be an antidote to politics as usual?
Well, again, we have to look at a little bit different definition of artist than is typical. I mean, people think of artists being simply, you know, painters or sculptors or in some cases musicians or writers or whatever. But I would extend the definition to include just about anything human beings are capable of. And the difference between an artwork and a mess is simply that the artwork has taken a certain amount of consciousness into its composition. And the difference between an artist and someone who is not an artist is a person who has put in some real effort in developing that kind of consciousness of what the difference between a mess and a masterpiece might be.
Whenever I see you, I remember that we met 20 years ago. You sat down to help write the GATT guide, which was the blueprint for what became the WTO that went to the Rio summit. And I never asked you what inspired you to become interested in globalization at a time where hardly anybody was.
What got me into the campaign in the first place was a kind of cumulative sense, I think starting in high school maybe, in the 1940s, that something not quite right was starting in this country. The impression was this is going to go global. And the way it struck me then was it had seemed to me that as a child during the Second World War, what was coming over the radio was kind of advice on how to be mutually helpful. And there was sort of a feeling about what American democracy was, a society of individuals cooperating together to achieve something. Now, this may be a very idealistic conception of it, but that's the way it came across to me as a child. And then after the war, it seemed to me there was a huge shift that was taking place in these broadcasts, and then this new thing of television that came in was, rather than being a society of individuals cooperating, we were a society of consumers. And it struck me, if we are all consumers, who is producing the consumables? Who is cleaning up the messes, and so on. And it seems to me by calling ourselves consumers, we were implicitly saying we are on top of the heap and everybody else is serving us. And that really bothered me in some deep sense. And then as I got into college and then afterwards, more and more I realized that this is a pattern that's going global. And it scared me.
Sue Dakin, our guest in this edition of Radio Curious, is the author of An Artist for President, The Nation is the Artwork, We are the Artists. Sue Dakin's website is anartistforpresident.com. We are joined in this interview by Mariah Gallardin, host and producer of TUC Radio. I'm Barry Vogel. Susanna Dakin, I want to talk a little bit about stewardship as a responsibility of having wealth beyond one's needs. And that presents an initial question. Who determines what the limits of one's needs are? How would you do that?
Very hard. I've stewed about that a little bit myself, wondering if some of the things I say in that book could be interpreted by some people as being an excess of control over people. I find myself really wondering if people need salaries in the millions and things like that.
Well, let me ask it from a different perspective, which is one much more personal and one that reflects the subject matter of your book, your candidacy. And that goes back to the terrible tragedy in your family in 1966, where you lost your parents, your brother, four out of five of your brother's children. And a consequence of that was that you and your surviving siblings inherited a considerable amount of money, perhaps more than you imagined. And my questions go to the stewardship responsibility of the money that you inherited and whether that had an effect on how you conducted, one, your decision to be a candidate, and two, your campaign.
One of the realities was that if I didn't have more money than I really needed to live on, I couldn't have done the campaign because it would have been impossible to raise money for.
It was essentially financed by you.
Right, yeah. I raised maybe 10% or less of what we spent.
How much did you spend?
In terms of political campaigns, not much, but it was, I think, about $130,000. We lived on people's living room floors or couches or whatever all over the country. So it was a very simple campaign.
Well, you go on to say in your book, An Artist for President, The Nation is the Artwork and We Are the Artists, that it took you about 25 years to figure out what you accomplished in your run for president. Can you share with us what you accomplished, what you believe you figured out? Let me say that again. Can you share with us what you figured out?
One of the things I figured out is I do have a right to call myself an artist, that there is a certain need for what might be called ego, but it's kind of the energizing central force in a person to get things done. And that this great war I'd had, that you mentioned earlier, internal war, was kind of a false war in a way.
The desire to have your art seen, but you remain as invisible as possible.
Right, right.
What do you mean by a false war?
I think I feared in myself something that probably was never a real danger. And that's, you know, just the exercise of empty ego. The exercise of ego for the sake of celebrity rather than for the sake of accomplishing something.
How did you see the empty ego in your run for the presidency?
The one time that I think I experienced what it would be like, in Houston, I found myself facing a much larger audience than I'd ever faced before. There were 700 or 800 people in a packed hall. You know, it was just full to capacity and some people standing and so on. And the story in the book, I kind of blanked out and don't know what I said, but people told me later that it was the best speech I'd ever made. And then after this, somebody stood up in the back. It turned out to be Sissy Farenthold, who was a representative to Congress, and at one time, I think, was almost governor of Texas, and was a vice presidential candidate at some point. But she stood up and talked about the value of what I was doing. And at that point, the whole audience stood up, gave her and me, you know, standing ovation. And I had this eerie sensation of all of a sudden my whole body getting much larger. And it was just bizarre. And also it was frightening to me because what it did, it was thrilling. It was a rush. And what it did for me was, I think, give me an insight into what a dictator must feel like who has power over the whole nation, you know?
Can you share with us that insight?
It's hard to describe. It was a physical feeling of just enormous power. I was the biggest person in the room, far larger than anybody else, and just powerful. But it was a physical feeling. It was not an intellectual concept.
What would one do with that power? You having felt it at that time in that room in Houston in 1984?
If I hadn't been frightened of it, I might have realized that it was a kind of tool with which to lead people. But I was really afraid of it.
What were you afraid of?
Being taken over by it. It, whatever it was.
The power.
Yeah.
Losing a direction. Going back to what we were saying before, was that related to understanding the consequences of what you do as a politician?
Yeah. I would guess that someone who's being taken over by that sense of power really loses a sense of being one of many people, you know, being an equal with others.
Abuse of power.
Yeah, it leads to abuse of power.
So that brings me to what you talk about kind of near the conclusion of your book. How can a serious contender for political office, for real public office, continue to keep going?
That was a question that came up for me many, many times. I came to the conclusion that I admired anybody, no matter what their principles or their ideas were, just who had the will and the ability to stick with this, because the business of campaigning is grueling. It's just even such a little campaign as mine was grueling in its own way. And now I think looking back on it, I think those moments where you get this kind of charge and this rush, you could take as simply a kind of refueling. And that may be, you know, what gives people like, for instance, Clinton, gave him the energy to keep on going in spite of everything and the kind of attack that he was under in office. I don't necessarily agree with everything Clinton did, but I admired the man for his kind of willingness to keep at it in spite of everything. I'm not sure I answered what your question was.
Works for me. Well, Susanna Dakin, author of An Artist for President, The Nation is the Artwork and We Are the Artists, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you about a eureka moment, an aha moment that changed your life, or perhaps that you still live by, an operative memory.
Somehow I think I've had a lot of aha moments, and it seems to me they kind of build on each other. I had this peculiar experience. I've been interested for the last 30 or 40 years, interested in Buddhism, and I would not call myself a Buddhist, but I'm interested in practices that they've developed over a few thousand years, and I've read a lot of Buddhist literature and so on. A few years ago, I went to a workshop or retreat conducted by a Thai forest monk, because I'd heard about these people and I really wanted to experience that. And I went and heard this guy. He has a lot of followers. And listening to him, of course, speaking through an interpreter and so on. But over the period of a few days, I kind of came to the conclusion that this guy was a little bit of a fraud, in that he was a person who was kind of ruled by ego in the form of egolessness, if that makes any sense. So anyway, this was a little disappointing, not hugely so, but anyway, it was an observation I made. As I was driving away from this workshop and driving home, I was just making a turn, and I suddenly had this a real aha moment or eureka moment or whatever. I suddenly realized I was happy. And the phrase that I'd heard many times, that we all have Buddha nature, every human being, every creature has Buddha nature ultimately. We just, you know, haven't got around to knowing it yet. And I just realized that was true. And it was such a lovely kind of clear moment. It was just really a thrill. And I think I've had different things that led up to that at various points. And I just, I realized those are just magnificent treasures.
And can you share with us what you would like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Be happy.
And is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
I've just read a book called The Empire of the Summer Moon, which is about the last 40 years or so of the Comanche Nation. And it's a very hard book to read in some respects, because I think it's the only book I have read about the native clash of Native American and white civilizations that neither romanticized the Native American nor excused the cruelties of either side.
Susanna Dakin and Mariah Gallardin, thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Barry. And Susanna.
Sue Dakin is the author of An Artist for President. The Nation is the Artwork, We Are the Artists. Sue Dakin and I were joined in this interview by Mariah Gallardin, host and producer of TUC Radio. Sue Dakin's website is anartistforpresident.com. Mariah Gallardin's website is tucradio.org. This interview was recorded in the studios of Radio Curious on November 25th, 2011. The book that Sue Dakin recommends is The Empire of the Summer Moon, Quanah Parker and the Rise and Fall of the Comanches, the Most Powerful Indian Tribe in American History, by S.C. Gwynn. All Radio Curious programs are free at our website, radiocurious.org. Our phone is 707-462-6541. Email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Anastad is our associate producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.